Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Frank Andre Garrity, whose new book is The Stadium, An American History of Politics, Protest, and Play. Andre Garrity is a professor of history and African American studies and the executive director of the Eric H. Holder Initiative for Civil and Political Rights at Columbia University. He is the author of three books, and today we're talking about his new book, The Stadium, An American History of Politics, Protest, and Play. We're speaking to him today from his home in New York. Frank, it's such a pleasure to meet you. It seems just perfect. Now that we've left the Olympics behind, where an entire city was a stadium, to look at the history you've recounted here of American stadiums. And this took 15 years to write?
Yeah, research and writing, yes. About 15 years. I mean, I have a day job as a professor, so there's stops there that have to happen. But I've been thinking and researching and writing about stadiums for far too long. 15 years is a long time.
Now, one of the things you bring home so beautifully is the complexity of these structures, how they mean so many different things to so many different people, and what roles they played in history.
What I'm trying to do in this book is to get us to think about this ubiquitous building that, you know, we see in cities and towns across the country and all over the world that we associate with sporting events and concerts, you know, Taylor Swift or Beyonce, whoever, and to think about them in a more expansive way, because they have played a more expansive role, certainly in the history of the United States, right? To think about them as institutions, whether they are the Louisiana Superdome, the Chase Center, or Wrigley Field or Yankee Stadium, right? Because even though their architecture might be different, they often fulfill the same function, which in American history, it's been a place where politics happens. It's a place that's totally contingent on politics because you need state support more often than not to build them, right? Because of our recurring tradition of singing the Star Spangled Banner before sporting events and other events, right? And because of the fact that there have been places where Americans have been fighting with each other about what it means to be an American, whether that's in the late 19th century or the middle of the civil rights movement, the 1950s and 60s, or in, you know, post-9/11 America, right? The stadium has figured prominently in the way we think about ourselves as a people. And that's really the story I'm trying to tell in this book.
And, for example, you open your book with the crowds at the Barclays Center after the murder of George Floyd.
That's exactly right, because I think what happens, certainly with the movement of Black Lives, when athletes, Black athletes in particular, get galvanized by the recurrence of police violence against Black people, unarmed Black people. You know, it's obvious to them at that point that people with a platform like athletes have to take a stand, and they do it at the place of work. They do it at the stadium when Colin Kaepernick and WNBA players and so many others take a knee or express themselves in solidarity with the movement for Black Lives against police violence. Right. So All this comes to a head in 2020 when the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, other arenas, becomes this kind of space where people gather to grieve the murder of George Floyd, to galvanize and protest all the racial injustices that are happening in that period. And so, it's really fascinating to see what happens with that arena. This is sort of square outside of it. It becomes a kind of space of protest and gathering that has nothing to do with the Brooklyn Nets or the other tenants who played there at the time.
Now, I have to say, I love the chapter about Madison Square Garden and its circus roots.
Yeah, and so that's the thing, right? So I think what often happens, understandably so, is that we tend to think of stadiums, you know, in a romanticized way. I mean, the typical stories that you see in books and told are kind of romanticized portraits of the golden age of ballparks and the ones that are still around, namely Wrigley Field and Fenway Park in Boston, right? I wanted to tell a story which shows that whether it's the circus tent that P.T. Barnum builds in what becomes the site of the original Madison Square Garden or your indoor arena or your college football stadium. You know, these structures have had enormous political, social, and economic impacts on American life. And so, you know, rather than tell the story starting with the baseball ballpark, I started the story with the circus. Because, I mean, the circus is a hugely popular 19th century amusement, and it plays a substantial role in the creation of the structures that we now know as indoor arenas.
Now, one of the essential chapters, which of course will interest local readers, is about the Sugar Bowl. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the research you did for that, because that is really a substantial story in this book.
Yes, it's really the story of how the stadium becomes a theater for the showcasing of the Jim Crow South in the first half of the 20th century. And again, we sort of know that story through the lens of segregation of Major League Baseball, but I wanted to talk about it with a kind of forgotten structure. Tulane Stadium, which existed on the campus of Tulane University, I mean, maybe not forgotten in New Orleans, but I think nationally it's been forgotten, which helped popularize college football. It is the place where the Sugar Bowl New Year's Day Classic that featured Southern teams and Northern teams usually every New Year's Day, you know, takes its shape, and it helps popularize college football and Tulane University and Southern college football in particular. And it becomes a stage where the North and South, you know, symbolically replay the Civil War. And if you look at the pregame and the halftime pageantry, you will see the staging of the imagined Confederacy that seemed to be living on in the 20th century. When you look at the rituals that we see happening at halftime with the Sugarettes, with the Confederate flags being waved and unfurled on the gridiron at halftime continually every single year, particularly in the 1940s and 50s, when the Civil Rights Movement is really picking up steam and starting to challenge segregation in that particular moment. And so, you know, I tell the story of the Sugar Bowl to talk about the ways that not just how the kind of Jim Crow order is being popularized through college football, but really how it's based on the kind of glorification of the plantation past. And just by calling the name the bowl game after the Sugar Bowl, it sort of highlights or obscures the centrality of sugar and slavery in the advent of New Orleans. And so that's the story I tell in that book, until the bowl is finally desegregated slowly but steadily in the late 1960s and moving into the 1970s.
And you write that the last game of the Jim Crow era was played in Tulane Stadium.
That's right, right? So basically, you know, by the time you're getting to, the Southern college football programs, whether it's Alabama or even Tulane, among others, right? I mean, they're the last bastion of Jim Crow in college sports. And that's happening at, you know, in a place like Tulane Stadium and other stadiums in the South. I mean, I think Tulane Stadium was really important because, not only because it sort of showcases kind of the white imagination of itself in the South, but it's also the place where, you know, three of the first nine Super Bowls are played. It's actually a place where we start to see the eventual collapse of Jim Crow segregation. So by the mid-1970s, you're seeing, you know, what becomes the Bayou Classic being played at Tulane Stadium in 1974, right? And so, you know, you see the tail end of that at the end of that stadium's history, and it really continues on with the advent of the Louisiana Superdome.
I was surprised, by the way, just not to see a little bit more about the Superdome, particularly in its role as a symbol of both good and bad during Hurricane Katrina. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I certainly can. You know, this book could have been all about New Orleans.
Of course, I mean, of course.
I mean, what an extraordinary place to study history for all sorts of reasons. I mean, I had a blast doing the research, and actually that Tulane research was really foundational in the emergence of this book. And, you know, if you look at highlight films, if you look at telecasts, which you can all see this on YouTube now, you see how radically different the Superdome as a space was compared to Tulane Stadium. I mean, like, you're really seeing the kind of post-civil rights era New Orleans, you know, taking shape right there in that huge structure, right? Which is totally different. It's an indoor stadium based on the Houston Astrodome. Of course, it is still to this day the most important sports arena in New Orleans, right? The Bayou Classic, you know, all sorts of things happening there, concerts, et cetera, and so on. And of course, the infamous housing of evacuees during the Hurricane Katrina, which, you know, exposed, you know, both the centrality of stadiums in American society beyond sports, but also the horrors of the experiences of the evacuees, you know, that August and September period, a terrible period in 2005 in New Orleans, right? So, yeah, I mean, I could have said a lot more about the Superdome, but I really was committed to sort of a national story, and I decided to move on reluctantly from New Orleans to talk about other places in the book.
Well, who knows? Maybe there will be a book about New Orleans in the future.
There's so much to write about New Orleans. It's such a great, it has this great history for all sorts of reasons.
really is. Now, one of the things that fascinates me is the way you've selected particular places to match particular social movements. I mean, I was fascinated by the Wattstack 72 concert at the Los Angeles Coliseum and its importance in civil rights.
Absolutely. You know, in some ways, you know, the L.A. Coliseum story is a bit of a continuation of the Louisiana story because of the prominence of Black Louisiana migrants who wound up in California during the second great migration of African Americans to Los Angeles. I mean, there's, you know, Brad Pye, the very famous Black sports writer who, you know, plays a key role in the management of L.A. Coliseum affairs because it's a public institution that's managed by a commission. He's a Black Louisiana migrant. I mean, he really is an exemplar of a kind of Black Louisiana diaspora in California, which has a huge role in the popularization of something that happens at the L.A. Coliseum, the advent of the Black College Football Classic, which, you know, which feature another Louisiana institution, the Grambling University Tigers, you know, playing college football games in Los Angeles in the late 60s, early 70s. But the event that I talk about most, you know, explicitly is the Wattstack concert, which was a, you know, an event that was put together by Black cultural activists in South Los Angeles and Stax Records, the record company that recorded so many famous Black soul musicians like Isaac Hayes, Staple Singers, among so many others. And they gathered together to put on this benefit concert 7 years after the famous Watts uprising when Black Latinos rose up against police violence and economic deterioration. And it turns out to be more than a concert. I mean, it was billed as the Black Woodstock, but it really was a celebration of Black power, a celebration of the optimism that Black communities are feeling in the early years after the Civil Rights era, right? When we start to see Black political representation become more palpable. Shirley Chisholm, you know, runs her very historic campaign as the first Black woman candidate for the presidency that year, right? And so all that sort of coming together in this concert that features all these great performers, but it has speeches by Jesse Jackson, it's announcing all these initiatives on civil rights. And so 100,000 people packed that arena. And it's not by accident that it happens there because the Coliseum was a public institution that was fairly accessible to a wide swath of Angelenos. And we see that legacy very clearly at the L.A. Coliseum on that memorable day 52 years ago.
And then in the Settler Stadium chapter, you talk about the controversy over the name of the Redskins.
Yeah, you know, so I really, again, continuing on the theme of public institutions, right, the old D.C. / RFK Stadium, which has been recently demolished, was actually on federal property. It was actually a federally managed facility that was a longtime Washingtonian institution. And it was built to house the Washington Senators MLB franchise, but also the Washington NFL franchise that used to be known as the Redskins, right, which had been owned by a well-known segregationist, George Preston Marshall. And it is actually the Kennedy administration that forces Marshall to desegregate his roster. It's the last team to desegregate in the National Football League. And he's able to do that because he's arguing that segregation violates civil rights laws, right? And so, you know, here you're seeing the kind of public nature of the stadium, you know, visibly in that case. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even as the franchise is desegregating, it's carrying on this odious tradition of Native mascotry, which, of course, is happening with all sorts of sports teams and institutions around the country. But because Washington is in the nation's capital, because that franchise becomes enormously successful, I wanted to tell the story of how is it that at the time that Black athletes and Black fans are being a visible part of the RFK Stadium scene, that this tradition of Native racism persists, right? And it persists because it carries on in these rituals that we see at that stadium and stadiums across the country for decades, right?
Right.
It's not until 2020 until the name is finally abolished or given up by the franchise, as we see also with the Cleveland Indians franchise in Major League Baseball, right? So, you know, rather than tell the story simply as the kind of legacy of a well-known bigot, I want us to wrestle with this kind of contradiction of inclusion happening on one level while persisting in the kind of denigration and these kind of harmful stereotypes of Native peoples that we saw palpably in that federally controlled structure for decades, RFK Stadium.
Oh.
Oh. If you're just joining us, my guest is Frank Andrew Garrity, author of The Stadium, An American History of Politics, Protest, and Play. I was fascinated, and this was one of the chapters I enjoyed the most, with The Inner Sanctum, which talks about access for women sports writers to press boxes and locker rooms. You really did a great job with that, I have to say.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. You know, one of the objectives of the book was, especially in the realm of sports history, although this is not just a sports history book. I mean, we tend to tell the story of inclusion through the lens of race. I mean, that's what we tend to do, right? And we tend to focus on African Americans, understandably so. But this is a book that's trying to show the impact of an array of freedom movements on this institution that I'm calling the American Stadium, right? And we see this clearly, inspired by the second wave feminist movement, in which we see women, you know, entering the realms of the workforce that have been excluded from it. One of those was the realm of sports journalism. And so, you know, the stadium by the late 60s, you know, is a male-dominated affair. In sports writing, it's a male-dominated affair. And the places of work, the press box and the locker room, are male-centered institutions, structures, right? I mean, in fact, there's to be signs that would be outside the press box with saying things like, no women or children should be present. So I wanted to tell a story of how do women stake their claims for equality and citizenship. They do it certainly on the field of play, most famously by Billie Jean King with the famous battle of the sexist tennis match in the Ashes of 1973, which, you know, is a well-known story. But the lesser-known story, I think, are the ways in which women argue that they have a right to cover sports like anybody else. And so that's the story I tell in that period, that the enormous sexism that they experience and the illogic of sexism, that somehow women being in the press box of the locker room would destroy the American family because these are, after all, women that just want to be close to naked athletes, which is not true. They just want to work, right? And this is still the very famous court case in 1978 in which Melissa Lutke and Time Life filed a lawsuit against the city of New York and the New York Yankees against the Yankees and MLB's policy to keep women sports writers out of the locker room. That process starts to change, right? And that case is won. But it isn't until the 80s and the 90s where we see women really break into women's sports journalism, although they still face sexism to this day, right? And so again, these struggles are happening at the place of work, and the place of work in this story, in this case, is the American Stadium.
Well, just the way you describe these women having to stand outside and wait for crumbs to write their stories is just incredibly annoying to read.
Yeah, there's a lot of detailing of the insidious forms of exclusion and discrimination that people experience, right? And I wanted that to come through. I want the reader to remember that, you know, we see women sportscasting, we celebrate the first woman play-by-play person today, but this is a long-haul struggle, and it really benefits. It really was just the culmination of you know, decades-long women who, you know, dare to say that they have a right to author the American sports story like anybody else.
But you also touch on the struggle for gay rights in a chapter called "Out at the Ballpark," set in San Francisco.
Yeah. Again, I mean, I really want to show the impact of different movements. I mean, I'm building on rich scholarship here. I'm not the first person to write about this stuff by any means, but I am among the first to talk about them in this particular way, right? And so I think in the midst, obviously, homophobia is a trans-historical phenomenon, but as gay communities are experiencing, you know, unprecedented sort of political leverage and cultural import, in particular with the advent of the disco movement in the 1970s, which was, you know, something that originates in queer communities and in communities of color, and it becomes very popular thanks to movies like Saturday Night Fever, which some of your listeners will remember. But it also really inaugurates this sort of counter-movement, this reactionary movement, you know, spearheaded by Anita Bryant and so many others, that was sort of targeting gay teachers and gay educators and fomenting homophobia throughout the country in the late 70s. One of the most famous instances of homophobia was the disco demolition riot, which happens at Chicago's Comiskey Park, in between the doubleheader between the Chicago White Sox and the Detroit Tigers, where a promotion to blow up disco records, this is very much part of this anti-disco movement, which was seen as a sort of an innocuous activity, turns into this major riot.
Yeah.
And if you watch the television telecast, the homophobic and anti-black content becomes very clear just in certain various moments throughout that telecast, even though it's often remembered fondly or at the very least as sort of an innocuous event. And so that's the context where we see the rise of the gays movement in San Francisco, not coincidentally the city that's really experiencing this flourishing of queer and LGBTQ communities in the 1970s. And one of them is led by Tom Waddle, who's insisting that, you know, he wants to create an athletic contest that showcases the athletic talents of queer people. He faces enormous persecution from the International Olympic Committee, which harasses him because they refuse to allow him to use the name Olympic. But the movement persists, and they staged the very first gay games at Kezar Stadium, yet another publicly controlled municipal stadium on the edge of the Haight-Ashbury district, which, you know, draws a modest crowd, about 10,000 people. But, you know, everybody who participated in that event talks about the enormous cultural and emotional impact of the gay and lesbian athletes parading around the field during the opening day ceremonies, right? And so it's this powerful moment in which the community is coming out at the ballpark, right? I mean, coming out is very much part of the master narrative of the arrival of gay and lesbian communities in the post-Stonewall world after the Stonewall Uprising in 1969. And so, you know, rather than, you know, engaging in the sort of, you know, kind of sociability that we see in bars, which is well known in gay communities, here we see them bringing that, you know, the gay community in all of its fullness, you know, on the field of Kezar Stadium in the early 1980s, in the midst of the gay of the AIDS crisis, which is another part of the story that becomes very important, right? So again, here we are seeing yet another social movement show itself in its presence in the American Stadium in that period.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frank Andrew Garrity, author of The Stadium, An American History of Politics, Protest, and Play. And then, of course, you write about war and democracy in stadiums. I think that's something that's not coming to an end, that we're going to see more and more of, don't you think?
That was a tough chapter to write because, you know, I'm writing about very recent history. You know, in that chapter, I'm writing about, you know, how September 11th, the terrorist attacks of September 11th, changed the culture and the function of the stadium, right? Certainly patriotic performances with the Star Spangled Banner ritual, you know, predates 9/11, but it really ramps up in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks, right? And what I show in that chapter is how patriotic expression gets narrowed to the celebration of the military and law enforcement, right? And that's the thing that I think we take for granted now, but it's certainly something that really takes shape after September 11th, right? And so, and it helps us explain the absolute intolerance of any political dissent at the stadium or the arena. Most, you know, visibly, as we will recall, with Colin Kaepernick's taking a knee protest in August 2016 and other athletes who joined him in the movement for Black Lives standing against police violence in the United States, right? And so I think what we're seeing here over recent years and now the kind of normalization of militarism in our society, right? And that's because of the wars that were waged in Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's very much part of the stadium repertoire to this day. At any major sporting event, this is what we see now, right? And so,
well,
you know, and I think that has a recent history. I think that's what I'm trying to say, particularly for young readers who may not know that, right? I mean, if you compare patriotic expression in the 1970s and 80s, it's very different than what we see now. And again, the sort of celebration of law enforcement and police forces, right? And I think that explains sort of the kind of polarized culture that we have around these questions to this day.
Well, they've never been merely sporting facilities. They're always places in the heart, too. Which is your favorite? If you had to choose a stadium that you admire for architecture or experience, which one would it be?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have a soft spot for the LA Memorial Coliseum. I mean, partly because this project started to come together when I had a residency in Los Angeles, but mm-hmm. I think because it's one of those buildings that where everything happens. You know, football games, track and field, rallies, the 1960 Democratic National Convention happens there, hosts the Olympics twice. Even the Los Angeles Dodgers MLB franchise plays there for a couple years before Dodger Stadium is built. You know, it really exemplifies all the functions that a stadium could provide for a community. I mean, right now it's mostly a college football stadium for the USC Trojans. But that's one of them. It's a single-tier facility, so you don't have the kind of, I mean, there are luxury suites now, but they only came along recently, right? And, but there are others. I mean, even among the newer structures, you know, even though I critique the kind of corporatized, you know, contemporary stadium, but, you know, the arena where the San Antonio Spurs play, I mean, I lived in Austin, so I'm a little biased towards Texas. you know, it's a place where you walk into that building and you know you're in San Antonio, right? There isn't a sense of no place that could be any place, right? There's a sense of like, okay, I know this is a city that has a large Mexican-American population. Mm-hmm. The atmosphere is, you know, usually even the teams are doing well, the fans are into it. You know, and so that's one of the rare contemporary venues where you really feel a sense of place. And I think that those are the two that stick out to me. There's an old structure, and that's the more recent one. I mean, there are others. I think that what we often see now, because of the proliferation of VIP sections and stadiums, you don't have the same atmosphere that you did years ago. I mean, you're really dealing with a less invested fan base, a more affluent fan base, less diverse in most cases. There's some exceptions to that. So in some ways, this is about asking us. This is a book that's trying to ask us to do better. It asks us to look at our history and see what this stadium history tells us and what that might mean for democracy and social equality and the present.
We've been talking with Frank Andre Garrity, whose new book is The Stadium, An American History of Politics, Protest, and Play. Frank, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for your time and your energy. It was a delight.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Two food cocktail demonstrations at the Jefferson Parish Library, one on each bank of the river, will celebrate the end of summer. Liz Williams, co-author of the So Fab Cookbook, will make Tennessee Williams Key Lime Pie. Tuesday, September 3rd at 6:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, and Camille Staub of So Fab will make Jammy Juleps. Wednesday, September 4th at 6:30 at the West Bank Regional Library in Harvey. Jay Hakes discusses and signs The Presidents and the Planet, Climate Change, Science, and Politics from Eisenhower to Bush. Thursday, September 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Amanda Jones discusses and signs That Librarian, The Fight Against Book Banning in America. Friday, September 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop in New Orleans. The Dickens Fellowship Reading Year begins Saturday, September 7th at 2 in the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. The first reading segment of the Pickwick Papers is chapters 1 through 11, and Dr. Christian Lemon will join the group via Zoom to introduce the posthumous papers of the Pickwick Club. New members are welcome. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.